Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 15, 10th hole. Scott was nervous now. It seemed like the whole thing hit him at once. He hadn't felt it when he shook Patterson's hand, or was briefly interviewed by Lucy Pendle. He hadn't felt it as Paul joked about ending up 10 under par for the round. It was the sudden silence that had spread in a wave through the crowd. It started around the tee, but then sounds that were more distant faded out, and there wasn't even a murmur from the clubhouse, where people were huddled around the television monitors the USA Sports crew had set up. Even though Scott couldn't see it, they all showed an image of him standing over his ball, his gaze searching the distance for something. When he saw Sarah, Sally, and Gina standing about 25 yards away, he knew what he had been looking for. Sarah blew him a kiss. He blew it back. In the control room, Bob had the second cameraman zoom in on the woman he had exchanged the kisses with. Jason immediately recognized Sarah. Scott Hanover just got a good luck kiss from his wife, Sarah. Interesting story how she got here, he said. More interesting is that they're expecting their first child in a couple of weeks. Okay, he's getting ready for his tee shot.
Using his driver,
Freddie added in his ear. Jason continued. He'll be using his driver on this par 4, 440-yard hole straight to the green. Some trees to the left, but nice and open on the right. With the fairway playing downhill, we should get some long drives. The words from Ellie replayed in his head as he made his comments. He'd be sure to ask her for some more advice as the play continued. The nervousness drained from Scott like a heavy bathrobe slipping off his shoulders to the ground. He exhaled deeply and shuddered with a warm wave. He took his practice swings and stepped up closer to the ball. His eyes focused on the duck. It seemed like all he could see was the ball, like it had enlarged to fill his entire field of view. With almost supernatural force, his body took over from his mind, and the club pulled straight back from the ball and hovered above his head for a brief instant before slicing through the air on the way down. The whoosh seemed to echo in his ears, and the plink of the metal clubhead hitting the ball rang in his head. The ball rose as it flew, faded a little to the right, and landed about 240 yards down the fairway, about 2 yards from the edge of the rough, and 5 yards from the feet of the crowd. The applause was polite and short. It wasn't an amazing shot, but to Scott, it was terrific. On a normal day, a 240-yard drive in the fairway was a great cause for celebration. Paul clapped his shoulder as Scott stepped out of the tee box. He gazed at Sarah. She was clapping and shouting and smiling bigger than he had seen in a while. His smile matched hers. He could walk off the course now and be a happy guy.
Now teeing off,
announced the voice from the clubhouse speakers,
Mr. Andrew Patterson of Wilmette, Illinois, at 4 under par after 9 holes.
The red-jacketed man nodded at Andrew to take his place in the tee box. Andrew let Eric place his driver in his hand and he stepped up. He placed a new tee into the ground, adjusted the height carefully, and then Eric handed him the ball. Jason absorbed the information Freddie was feeding him from the studio into his headphones. He raised his eyebrows as he learned more about the eclectic golfer now standing on the tee. Andrew Patterson, although 3 strokes behind at this time, is the favorite to win today. His major competition, Joe Culkin, had to bow out due to a broken wrist he suffered last week. Oddly enough, his replacement, Scott Hanover, is actually ranked last of the golfers playing today. A strange turn of events, and one I'm sure Mr. Culkin is watching with great interest. Andrew Patterson is undefeated in his amateur tournament play, and has only been playing golf for the last 2 years. He turned off his mic feed and asked Freddie, "Is that right?" "You bet," answered Freddie. Jason remained silent while Patterson readied himself to tee off. Andrew placed the ball on the tee and stood up. He glanced down the fairway and almost imperceptibly shook his head as his gaze landed on Hanover's ball to the right. He was in a bad position for approaching the green. There was a bunker directly between him and the pin, which would require the amateur to stick a 200-yard shot. Andrew was aiming for the left side and knew he would be about 20 yards further than Hanover with a good roll. He was hoping for a slight draw to pull the ball to the left and stay out of the rough. He lined up his driver behind his ball. His trajectory was lower to start than Scott's, but rose and drew to the left. It landed even with Hanover's, then rolled a little to the left of center, 20 yards past the first golfer's ball. Perfect, he thought. The applause was greater than Hanover had received. Andrew thought perhaps it was due to the extra distance he had obtained, but it was far shorter than he was capable of if he wanted to give up some of his accuracy. The golfers and their caddies started walking away from the tee box down the fairway. The crowd surged behind them, but kept a 15-yard buffer zone without the need for tournament officials to control their movement. Ellie followed them with her camera, and Lucy Pendle was keeping up along the side of the fairway, listening intently to instructions over her headphones from the director. Ellie couldn't hear them, but soon her own headphones crackled to life, followed by a question from Jason Bernard. She had been following his commentary so far and thought it was pretty good. She knew someone had been feeding him information, but she seemed pretty confident that his analysis of the hole came straight from her.
"Ellie, are you there?"
asked Jason. She clicked her transmit button. "Right here," she answered.
"Any more comments on this hole?"
"Just that Patterson has a better approach to the green from the left side. Scott Hanover is going to have to contend with the sand trap on the right."
"Do you think Patterson planned it that way?"
asked Jason. "Absolutely. He hits it where he wants and manages the course better than anyone I've ever seen."
"But not Hanover?"
"No. He's been very lucky today, but I don't think he'll make the green in 2. That'll make it tough to get par. On the other hand, Patterson could birdie if he gets close enough to the pin."
"Thanks, Ellie. Can I bug you later?"
"Sure thing, boss," she answered. She clicked off her mic and smiled. By the time these 9 holes were over, Jason Bernard would have a reputation as a pretty good golf commentator. She wished she was producing this event. She had dozens of ideas bubbling. Andrew stopped about 10 yards behind Scott's ball. The crowd had fallen further behind and spread out over the whole fairway. If other golfers had to follow behind them, they couldn't. He took in the lie that Hanover found himself with and smiled. Andrew was confident that his superior drive would take 1 stroke off Hanover's lead. There was no opportunity for Hanover to birdie, and a pretty good chance he would bogey this one, especially if he landed in the sand. Andrew's smile reflected more than his own excellent tee shot. he relished the predicament that Hanover had gotten himself into. Scott and Paul looked at their position. "Well, Scott," started Paul, "that sand is a problem. If you try to hit over it from here, you'll roll off the back and probably end up in that tree line. You could hit it short and chip on in three." "Think I could roll right through the sand?" asked Scott. "Not with the lip on the trap. I'd hit your 7-iron, then chip the 25 yards over the sand." Scott turned back to look at Patterson, then turned back to Paul. "He's smiling. He knows he's picked up at least a stroke on you already. He's good, Scott. But remember, you're not here to beat him."
"I'm not?
Oh, yeah. I'm just playing golf. Trying to beat this guy is the surest way to lose. Play it smart and get a good chip. If you bogey, you bogey."
"Okay," Scott agreed.
"The 7 it is." Paul pulled out the club and handed it to Scott. Scott looked for Sarah and found her halfway to the green and smiled at her. It was strange having her here. Now he was beginning to think he might do better if she wasn't. But the more he considered it, the more he felt her presence helped. It gave him a focus, and he hoped she might become more understanding of his passion for the game. He chopped a couple of practice swings, lining up to the left of the sand trap, in case the ball rolled further than anticipated. Ellie whispered into her mic for Jason.
"He's using a 7-iron. He's going to play it safe and hit it short," she added.
She listened as Jason seamlessly incorporated her observations into his commentary. As Scott ready to swing, a quick thanks from Jason came in through her headphones. Scott hit the ball less than perfectly. It sailed more to the right than to the left. He had turned his club open a little as he swung. The ball landed 5 yards behind the sand trap's right edge. It was safe, but he had the whole length of the sand trap to clear to get it on the green. The applause was sparse and weak. He shook his head a little and handed his club to Paul.
"Hey," Paul said, "it's not in the sand."
"Not in the sand," echoed Scott. Patterson and his caddy tromped past them, neither of them looking back. Eric handed Patterson his 7-iron, and Patterson walked up to the ball. He stopped for a moment to check the wind on his face. "It shouldn't be a factor," he thought. He let his club sit on the grass an inch behind the ball, and as the sole rested on the ground, his left arm hung loose, and he allowed the club to tell him where it wanted to be. He gripped the handle and rocked his feet a little, adjusting his balance. He took another glance at the flag hanging limp on the pole, then looked at the ball, then swung the club. A strip of grass in front of the ball followed it into the air. The ball was high and straight, and landed on the front edge of the green, rolling another 4 yards. He was 2 yards from the hole in perfect position. Easy par was his plan, but a birdie sat in the back of his mind. The applause was more vigorous, and he sensed the crowd possibly turning allegiance. Most of these people had come to see Hanover try to duplicate his first 9 holes. Andrew was confident they would still get a good show, just not the one they expected.
"Wow," Scott muttered, "that was pretty good.
From where he was hitting, he had a great approach to the green."
"You'll have to help me do that," said Scott.
"Hey, I'm happy every time you hit the fairway."
"Touché," agreed Scott.
They walked to Scott's ball. Sarah was in the crowd nearest to where his ball landed.
"Nice shot, Scott," she yelled.
"He did land a good one," joked Scott.
"Not him, you. But you missed the sand pit. Isn't that extra points?" she asked.
"I don't want extra points."
"Oh,"
Sarah said as she chuckled at her joke. Paul handed Scott his pitching wedge.
"A lob wedge would come in handy here," he pointed out.
"If I knew how to hit one."
"A minor point," added Paul. "Then again, you don't know how to hit any of your clubs."
Scott laughed and nodded. He looked at his ball. The grass was tall and thick and helped to support the ball slightly above the ground. He swung his club through the grass a couple of times to get a feel for the drag on his swing. He measured out a backswing he figured would land the ball just past the sand and let the ball roll to the pin.
With his feet lined up on the flag, he stood ready to hit his third shot. In the hole, he told himself. He pulled back 2 feet and chopped the club under the ball, clipping the grass along the path of the club in the process. The ball lifted free and bounced too close to the lip of the sand trap for comfort, but then it landed on the green and rolled straight up to the pin. An unseen bump in the path of the ball caused it to break an inch to the left. It was enough of a deflection to deny Scott another birdie. The ball passed over the rim of the hole and stopped 4 inches from the cup. The applause was almost deafening. "I don't believe it," said Lucy Pendle from behind Scott. She walked up to Scott, listened to a voice in her headphones, then pointed Scott's eyes to the camera across the green. "Terrific shot. That should have been in," said Lucy. "I'll take a par any day," answered Scott. "Good answer," muttered Paul. "Well, Andrew Patterson has got to feel a little pressure on his putt after that chip," continued Lucy. Scott thought about it for a moment and answered, "You know, somehow I doubt it." Lucy raised her eyebrows in surprise. She looked back to the camera in the distance. "Back to you, Jason." She lowered her microphone and was slowly nodding her head as she looked at Patterson's cool posture and relaxed appearance. "I kind of doubt it, too," she muttered. Scott took his putter, and Paul left the golf bag on the side of the green. Andrew nodded his approval for Scott to finish the hole out of turn. Paul pulled the flag, and Scott tapped in his ball for par. Paul handed the flag to Eric Peters, and the pair stepped off the green. "Think I'll make it?" whispered Scott. "What, par or the birdie?" "Birdie? I don't know. I don't think he's counting on it. I'm pretty sure he wasn't counting on you parring the hole." Andrew stepped up and squatted to examine the ground between his ball and the hole. It was pretty much a straight shot. He concentrated on just one thing. He didn't want to leave the ball short. If he hit it too light and it stopped inches from the hole, then he would have wasted a birdie chance. It was better to hit it a little bit beyond the hole, but not too much. If he missed the birdie, then he'd have an easy par putt. He stood and took his putter from Eric. This was the first time most of the people watching had a chance to see Andrew's special club. He heard a murmur of comments and ohs and ahs that were hushed by the officials around the green. He lined up his putter and drew it back 4 inches, then hit the ball. It rolled straight toward the hole and dropped in, bouncing off the back of the cup before hitting bottom. The response to Andrew's putt exceeded that for Hanover's chip shot. He smiled as he took his ball from the hole. As he walked to where Eric stood, he resisted the urge to hold the ball up in acknowledgement. He handed him the putter and continued, not waiting for his servant. Officials held back the crowd as the camera crews and golfers made their way through the narrow path in the trees. The scorecard holder quickly updated the scores. Patterson was now 2 strokes back, with 8 holes left to play. Harold Frisk puffed at his cigar and nodded. So far, so good. The 10th hole had a bit of excitement, and now the play was closer than before. Ideal elements to keep the viewers viewing and, consequently, watching those commercials. He figured they could fit in 2 or 3 spots before the golfers had to tee off again. He had been watching the feed on a portable monitor the control room technician had given to him. An earpiece let him follow the commentary and communications with the control room. Carl Bateman had more than once looked over Frisk's shoulder to see what was happening, but gave up after it became apparent that Frisk didn't want to share his toy. Bernard had been doing a good job with his commentary, and Frisk had been surprised to hear Ellie giving her analysis of the course as well over the earpiece, something Freddie wasn't equipped to do, but Ellie seemed to have a knack for. Fortunately, Bernard had the good sense to make use of it. Bateman's golf cart had been the first through the path in the trees, and he parked on the right side of the tee about 10 yards down the fairway. Even without the monitor, Carl wasn't going to miss anything. "That was an incredible chip," said Sally, as she and Gina helped Sarah along and followed the silent woman in the red jacket.
I thought it was going in, said Sarah. My jaw must have been hanging to the floor. If I knew he was this good, I would have skipped that rummage sale this morning to see him play the first 9 holes, although I still don't understand everything about this game.
I'm pretty good at understanding most sports, Gina said. Comes from dating a sports agent. What questions do you have?
Well, this may sound stupid, but why are they using those big fat-headed clubs to tee off, but then use the flat ones on the fairway?
You really don't have much understanding.
Well, I know they have to hit it in the hole, and that par is the number of strokes it should take, but the different clubs seem confusing.
Basically, began Gina, there are 3 kinds of clubs. The woods, which have the big fat heads, the irons, which have the flat heads, and the putter.
Putters I know from miniature golf, Sarah said.
Basically, it's the same thing here, said Gina. The woods will hit the ball further than an iron, but generally have less control. Most golfers have 3 or 4 woods in their bag. The one that Scott used to tee off is called the driver, but is also considered a 1-wood. As the number increases, the loft of the club increases, and the distance it can hit shortens.
I guess that makes sense.
Usually they'll have a 3 and 5 wood in addition to the driver.
What happened to the 2 and 4? Asked Sarah.
That I couldn't tell you, Gina said, laughing. In the irons, they also start out at 1 and usually go through 9 being the shortest distance. But then there are various wedges, too.
Wedges?
They are basically irons that have even more loft. Scott used a pitching wedge to hit onto the green. There are also sand wedges and loft wedges, depending on the conditions. Usually players don't have a 1 or 2 iron, but some do.
That's just too confusing.
It can be, but to answer your question, they pick a club that will allow them to hit the distance they want the ball to go. Most of the time they'll want a long tee shot, then use an appropriate iron or wedge to get onto the green.
Scott took 3 shots to get on the green. Is that bad?
If you don't hit it 4 inches from the hole, it can be.
If he had 2-putted, it would have been a bogey.
Right, bogey. And a birdie is?
A birdie is 1 under par, which is what Andrew Patterson scored.
Now Scott is only winning by 2 strokes.
Right.
Why don't they just list their total score? Why all this under par stuff?
I guess it lets other golfers figure out how far ahead or behind they are, no matter where they are on the course.
Don't worry, Sarah, added Sally. You'll pick it up.
I'm just glad to be here. I think it really means a lot to him.
Oh, I know it does, added Gina.
Gina and Sally came to a halt as I realized Sarah had stopped a step earlier. She was holding her belly, and her face twisted into a wide grin. She blew out some air, stretched her neck a bit, then smiled.
That was invigorating, she said.
The two women looked at each other, slightly confused.
Are you okay? Asked Gina.
Fine.
Sarah was moving again. The two women quickly found themselves jogging a couple of steps to catch up.
She's fine, echoed Sally.
Couldn't be better, added Gina as they caught up.
Is it true you've only been playing golf for 2 years? Asked Lucy Pendle. She had managed to pull Andrew Patterson aside before he could make his way to the 11th tee.
Yes, answered Andrew without expounding.
Lucy paused, waiting for more, but Patterson just smiled.
What made you decide to play?
I like to set challenges for myself, in my business life and my personal life. My goal was to play in a PGA tournament within 4 years. After today, I will have reached that goal in half the time I set aside.
If you win, added Lucy. Her comment was met with an unusual look, as if any sane person doubted that Andrew Patterson would emerge victorious from the tournament.
Would you consider yourself a natural golfer?
Do you mean to ask if I have a natural ability at this game?
Yes.
No, I have studied golf and the techniques and methods needed. I've obtained the best equipment available, and I know my potential and my limitations. I don't rely on luck, and I don't take chances.
Seems like a sensible way to approach the game.
I think so.
The results are self-evident. Well, you are two strokes behind.
Actually, considering where I expected to be at this point in my game, I'm two strokes ahead. Mr. Hanover will have a tough time maintaining his streak. As you saw, he has no course management and has to rely on lucky shots.
It only takes one lucky shot a hole, Lucy pointed out.
Andrew smiled. I must get ready. I'm due to tee off.
Lucy looked at the camera Louis Filtree held. And there is Andrew Patterson, confident and apparently possessing the skill and precision to back it up. Karen Blakely had managed to work her way through the crowd to where Andrew Patterson was being interviewed. Andrew seemed to be handling himself well. As he finished, she waved at Patterson and smiled. He nodded in acknowledgement. Good. Andrew knew she was there, and now she could make sure that her interests were being promoted. A sudden bump from behind her nearly knocked her to the ground. She steadied herself and turned around. It was the cameraman who had just finished shooting the interview.
Sorry, he apologized.
You nearly knocked me over, she protested.
My fault entirely, agreed Louis Filtree.
He eyed Karen. She was a mess, but was also pretty hot.
You've been watching the tournament? He asked.
She responded with a look that pointed out what a stupid question that was. She was here, wasn't she?
A lot of water on this hole, observed the cameraman.
Karen remained silent. Down the fairway, the crowd was forced to spread out, as the gold tee was set back in a little cove of trees, which provided little space for anyone other than the golfers, caddies, and the plump, no-necked, red-jacketed official who was acting as referee. The fairway of the long par 5 twisted around two water hazards, the first on the left and the second on the right.
Betcha Hanover knocks another one into the water.
Another one? Asked Karen. How had he gone 7 under par hitting balls into the water?
Yeah, nailed the water hazard on 8. He still ended up parring the hole. I wasn't here when it happened, but I got tape of the guys getting the ball.
Somebody went in to get Scott Hanover's ball? She asked. Didn't the officials try to stop them?
What officials? Asked Louis.
When he was golfing. There must have been someone there to keep onlookers out of the water.
Oh, they didn't get it then. It was after Patterson and his group finished the hole. They had scuba equipment and everything.
Scuba equipment? How do you know they were going after Hanover's ball? She asked. Something didn't sound right here. Who would bring scuba equipment to a golf tournament?
Why else would they be there? They only pulled out one ball.
That is strange. Jake let the people file past him. It didn't take long for the 10th hole to become as deserted as the 9th already was. Some litter reminded him of the throngs of onlookers who had flowed like an alien creature from a horror movie. He looked at his own scorecard and saw that he was about 300 yards from the 14th tee. He then looked at his watch. It was maybe 45 minutes to an hour before the golfers would work through the next 3 holes. He decided to wander back to the control room and watch the action on some of the monitors set up for public view. He thought about getting a cold drink, a soft drink. He patted his pockets, searching for his wallet, and found the tubular object in his shirt pocket. He pulled out the cigarette. It had been slightly flattened, and the end was ragged and starting to crumple. He held it in his right hand and looked at it. For 15 years he had smoked them, and now, for the last 6 hours, the thought had rarely crossed his mind. There was something else in the pocket, flat and smooth. He didn't have to take it out to remember. It was the picture of him and Brad. He remembered why he kept the cigarette. It was to celebrate signing Andrew Patterson. He suddenly realized that at the time he made the deal with himself, Karen Blakely had probably already done the deed. He rolled the paper tube to restore its cylindrical shape and put the filter end into his mouth. Absently, he searched his pockets for a match or a lighter. After a few seconds, he stopped himself, closed his eyes, and exhaled deeply. Was he ready to make such huge changes in his life? He had messed up getting Patterson, and Hanover wasn't very excited about a career as a golf spokesman. He pulled the cigarette from his mouth and walked towards the clubhouse. Near the 10th tee was a wire garbage can. He crumbled the cigarette over the container. He hadn't earned it, and it would only take one puff for him to go buy a pack at the liquor store on Central. And then, why not a six-pack as well? By 6 o'clock, he'd be sitting in a bar watching the sports report with Karen Blakely standing in the background behind Andrew Patterson. Alternatively, he could buy Scott, Sarah, Paul, and Gina dinner at a nice restaurant and get back on track for a normal life. Brad Finley was in the past. Maybe it was time to do something positive with his life. As long as Gina stayed with him, there was a chance it could be something good. Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, cozy mysteries about a crime-solving veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.